I'm Richard Harmon, and I've been a member of the church here for about 30 years. I taught New Testament and one little course in philosophy of religion at the Anglican School of Theology until its closure in 2005. So I was out there for 15 years. In my background, I had been in ecumenical work, working with the National Council of Churches and other groups like that, leading scholars' dialogues and that sort of thing. So that gave me a little bit of help along the way. When I first thought about this, I wondered, how in the world are you going to get such a broad topic in 35 minutes? And I thought maybe the best thing to do would be to get at the background or the context of Jesus' ministry and life as a way of helping us to understand what he was about, what he said, why he said it, and this sort of thing. I used as a basic resource, or as a major resource, in my preparation, N.T. Wright's little book on Simply Jesus. I found it very helpful and very thought-provoking, very insightful. But bear in mind, it's one particular perspective. And I appreciated what Mother Erin had to say. There are other perspectives, and we're going to be studying these for a lifetime. So remember that there are other ways of looking at this too. But you'll hear one tonight. Okay? Who is Jesus Christ? The question, it seems at first, is deceptively simple and not a little unnecessary. Well, duh, everybody knows who Jesus Christ is. But the question I'm asking is a bit more complex than this. What did Jesus do? What did Jesus really say? What did he mean? Could it be that he's larger than the church has imagined, lo, these many years? Most of what we know about Jesus comes from the Gospels, and they're each written from a favorable perspective. So what can we glean from them? Well, first of all, Jesus is a figure of history, born somewhere around 4 BC, give or take a couple of years or so, somewhere in that vicinity, but about 4 BC. His mother was related to the priestly families in Judaism. He had a cousin named John who might have been a priest had he chosen to take that particular route, but he didn't. His mother's husband was from the ancient family of King David, although this had no particular status by the time of Jesus in Jewish life. We know very little about his early life, just a couple of things from the Gospels, so both of them happening in the temple. One in Luke and one in Matthew. So far as we know, he never traveled outside the Middle East. He never married. From complete obscurity, he suddenly came to public notice around the late 20s of the first century. Most of what we know of him is packed into a span of 1 to 3 years, but no more than that. He was picked up by the authorities in Jerusalem. He was tried and executed as a would-be rebel. King of the Jews, the placard read. He died by crucifixion somewhere around 30 AD during the Passover season. All the Gospels, save Mark in its short form, contend that God raised him from the dead and that he lives to this day. Our Gospel sources for this information are dense, are complex, or multiple. If we want to understand them, we've got to get inside them to tease out what they have to say and what they have to tell us about Jesus. We need to get inside the worldview of the first century. And that's hard to do because they didn't think like we do about many things in that day and age. And we're going to talk about some of those things tonight to try to help us get into the life of Jesus. We need to understand what he meant by the term God. For example, a God who lived way in heaven and relegated things to earth, or a God who was involved and got involved with things in this earth that he created. And why Jesus often acted like he was in charge, forgiving sins, for example. This would involve examining how the first century world viewed space, time, and matter. So let's look at these and see if they can help us inform us about this person we call Jesus. For many, many centuries, in later years, mapmakers put Jerusalem at the middle of the world. Most of the Jews of the first century felt that way about Jerusalem, but particularly about the temple. The temple was the heart of everything. It was the holiest spot on earth. It was where God was to dwell. It was where God had promised to dwell. The temple was the place where God himself had promised to come and to live. Malachi had said so, and other prophets had done the same thing. More importantly, it was the place where heaven and earth met. Think of a Venn diagram, those of you who are mathematicians. We could draw it on the board. Two circles that intersect. Heaven would be one, earth would be the other, and where they intersect would be the temple. This is what the temple was seen of in those days. In first century thought, heaven and earth were not that far apart. They were very close, and they interacted. Jesus went about saying that God was right now becoming king, bringing in his kingdom, and establishing his long-awaited rule on earth as it is in heaven. Does that ring a bell? The prime example of this can be found in Luke 4, 16 through 21. And let me just remind you of this as we look at it. It could be called Jesus' Nazareth Manifesto. When he came to Nazareth, this was at the very beginning of his ministry, where he had been brought up, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. Then he began to say to them, "Today," and this is the important thing, "today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." Jesus went about saying that the kingdom of God was breaking in then. The future had invaded the present, but not in a way that his hearers expected. The rest of that story bears this out, because you see, when they found out the kingdom wasn't exactly the one they were anticipating, they almost killed it. So from the very beginning, there was danger in Jesus' ministry. From the very beginning. The other thing about this was that this kingdom that was coming into being that Jesus was talking about was not happening in the temple. It was not happening in the temple. Heaven and earth were indeed overlapping, and the kingdom was being established where Jesus was, and where and in what Jesus was doing. It seemed as though Jesus was subtly saying, in a sense, he was replacing the temple. The temple had outlived its usefulness. What did the temple become by Jesus' day? Well, for one thing, it was the center of the banking system of that day. It was where the record of debts were kept, where everyone's debts were kept. So you had a high priest living in luxury, presiding over a system of crushing debt. In an earlier revolt, a few years back, before Jesus' time, rebels had taken control of the temple, and one of the first things they did was to burn those records to release the people from their debts. The temple had come to symbolize the nationalist movement in Judaism. God would do victorious battle against Israel's oppressors. And they had thought this for years. Battle and temple had been linked for 1,000 years since the reign of David in the mind of Judaism. Instead of a place for all nations, as the prophets had declared, the temple had become a symbol of Israel's violent ambitions. Her hopes for a military victory over her oppressors. Israel's ancient calling to be a light to the Gentiles was being turned on its head. It just wasn't that anymore. Jesus came as the Prince of Peace, behaving as if he were the temple, redefining sacred space around himself. This was extremely risky and nothing like the first century Jews expected of anyone like a prophet, much less a Messiah. This just was unheard of. What about time? Jews in Jesus' day, as well as our own, have a very special sense of time. It is moving forward in linear progression toward an ultimate purpose. The Sabbath day was an example and an illustration of this. It was the day God rested from creation, but also a foreshadowing of the time when God's purposes for creation would be fulfilled. The work would finally be done, and God and his people could enjoy it, could rest. The Sabbath was the time when God's time and human time coincided. It was to time as temple was to space. The book of Leviticus in chapter 25 had spoken of a jubilee year at the end of 7 weeks of years, or in other words, 49 years. The 50th year was the jubilee year, at which time debts would be erased, the land would rest, and the people would be set free. A kind of Sabbath, if you please. The book of the prophet Daniel had proclaimed a great Sabbath coming when people would finally be free. Now, that phrase that you encountered last week in the first chapter of Mark, verse 15, the time is fulfilled, now that has meaning. It makes sense as Jesus' announcement at the beginning of the ministry. Jesus was saying, the Sabbath is here. The Jubilee year is here. The past has invaded the present. The time people were longing for was here in what he was doing and what he was saying. Here was a new creation indeed. A new creation. A new kingdom. And it was interesting talking about a new kingdom that would be somewhat akin to someone coming along today and saying tomorrow on the news, the present administration is out. I'm the new president. I don't think that would set well in Washington. It didn't set well in Jerusalem either. You're ready for it, you say. What about matter? The world of matter in ancient thought was made by God, not only to display his beauty and his power, but also as a vessel for his glory. Again and again, the Psalms and the prophets proclaim this. Habakkuk said, "The earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh as the waters cover the sea." We tend to see the material world as tightly bound. In the Western world, we tend to see the material world as tightly bound to the laws of chemistry and physics, and not particularly sacred, in part or in whole. We find this kind of idea in Native American thought, oftentimes, and in the Aboriginal groups in Australia, but not so much in Western thought. The world is just not that sacred, in part or in whole. In the Gospels, the healing stories offer glimpses of this transformation of the material world with the coming of God's kingdom. There are several of these in Jesus' ministry. In them, people's bodies are being transformed by a strange kind of power that Jesus says comes from him or of him, out of him. You're going to see that in Mark, the 5th chapter, when you get to that. But Jesus talks about this. But the greatest example of this transformation of matter is the transfiguration itself. Here God comes not to the temple in Jerusalem, but to Jesus himself. In Jesus' day, there was a fervent belief that God would return to the temple, take up residence there, and set things right with Israel and with the nations. What the story of the Transfiguration demonstrates is that Jesus seems to be the place where God's world and ours meet, where God's time and ours meet. And he's the place God's matter, our new creation, intersects with ours. Now we can begin to catch a glimpse of the arena into which Jesus walked. And some have called this walking into the perfect storm. I don't know if you read that book by Sebastian Younger, was that right? The Perfect Storm. The conflagration of three weather patterns. This is exactly what was happening in Jesus' life. What were the three elements in this combination of perfect storm into which Jesus walked? The first was the oppression of the Roman government on hapless Israel. The Emperor Augustus was known as the Son of God, and he had taken on priestly roles in his reign. He was said to be ushering in a new age, a new kingdom of justice, peace, security, and prosperity. Augustus was called King of the World. The second element was the failed Jewish leadership caught up in hopes of a military rebellion that they hoped would restore their freedom. The Jews had lived this idea out for 1,000 years and had a definite nationalistic goal in mind. They thought that someday God would send someone to take over, to help them take over and overthrow the yoke of Rome or whoever it was that was oppressing them at that time. And the third element in this perfect storm was Jesus' preaching that God himself had come already to set up his kingdom on earth as it is in heaven, doing what nobody else could do. Jesus believed that his coming to Jerusalem in the last days of his ministry embodied or incarnated the return of Israel's God in power and in glory. Zechariah, Isaiah, and Daniel had all anticipated this, and it said something about such a convergence. Jesus seems to have had their writings in the back of his mind as he proceeded with his ministry. For example, in the last days of his ministry, riding into Jerusalem on a donkey, sort of illustrating Zechariah's example in his writings. But he was moving counter to this nationalistic expectation. He was doing the unexpected. He was not acting exactly like a Messiah or prophet. And this was risky business. It led to his death. Jesus' words and deeds brought forth a wave of questions from his friends and his foes alike. All of this boiled down to the question, who are you? What in the world are you up to? What are you about? He didn't fit neatly into any mold. prophet, priest, Messiah. He didn't fit the contemporary conceptions of the day. What Jesus has done was to do something that, as far as we know, nobody else had ever done before him, or he had coupled some passages in the Old Testament. He had combined Psalm 2 with Isaiah 42, and he had combined Isaiah 52, 7 to 12, with Isaiah 52, 13 to 53, 12, the suffering servant passages. That is to say, the announcement of God's kingdom and his return to Zion, which was anticipated by the prophets, with the accomplishment of the suffering servant. It was one or the other, but not both, in contemporary Jewish study and thought. You were either the Messiah, but you didn't suffer, or the other way around. This was revolutionary in first century Jewish thought because nobody had ever combined these two before. Jesus' vocation to be Israel's Messiah and his vocation to suffer and die belong intimately together. All four Gospels insist that the cross was to be seen as the throne that Jesus was ascending. On it was the inscription, King of the Jews. Somehow Jesus' death was seen by him and later writers as the ultimate means by which God's kingdom was established. There is a real sense, a very real sense, in which the crucifixion was the answer to the prayer that God's kingdom would come on earth as it was in heaven. In the final analysis, Rome was not the real enemy to be overcome. The real enemy to be met by the power and love of God was the anti-creation power, the power of death and destruction, which had been seen in most of the biblical materials as a consequence of individual sin. Jesus had glimpsed his own role in the long biblical story. Many biblical writers spoke of the suffering that would come upon God's people, climaxing at the time of the Messiah, when evil would do its worst, only so that its defeat could pave the way to the redemption that God had in mind all along. The key to it all is the belief that as Israel's Messiah, Jesus did indeed represent his people. The one stands in for the many. John 15:13 comes to mind. No one has greater love than this, that a man lay down his life for his brother or his friends. If the Christian faith is true, that 3 days later God raised Jesus from the dead to launch God's new creation, then Jesus' death, like Jerusalem in those ancient maps, is the center point of the world. When God raised Jesus from the dead, he rose as the beginning of the new world God had always intended. The stories about resurrection don't coincide with what first century Jews thought about resurrection. For one thing, they thought it was something, a general resurrection that was to happen at the end of time, rather than a specific resurrection to someone in the middle of time. This was totally new in their way of thinking. These resurrection stories seem to be about a person who is equally at home on earth and in heaven. Remember, in biblical thought, as we said a while ago, heaven and earth were closely aligned. They weren't so far apart in the thinking of that day. In the new world Jesus inaugurated, there is a completely new way to live, a way of love and reconciliation and healing and hope. The message of Easter in its most profound depth is not primarily that there is life after death and we're bound for heaven. It's about a new way and a phase of life that God intended for his creation being established. The Easter stories at the end of the Gospels are not about an end, but about a beginning. The beginning of God's new world and the kingdom. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Luke describes in Acts 1, verse 9, Jesus being lifted up and taken by a cloud out of sight. It's hard to say what he has in mind here. Apart from the literal understanding, there are at least two other possibilities at hand. Luke may have been recalling, as his readers surely would have, that passage in Daniel 7, chapter 13th verse, where one like a son of man comes on the clouds of heaven to be presented before and enthroned beside one who is called the Ancient One. This is the moment when Israel's representative is installed as the true world ruler with all nations subject to him. And he may have been trying to say this about Jesus. From another perspective, Luke's readers would also be familiar with the world of the Roman Empire. After the death of Julius Caesar, some people swore they had seen his soul ascending to heaven. The same had been said for Augustus. So Luke, in essence, was upstaging Caesar. Recall that the close of Acts, the very close of Acts, ends with Paul announcing God as king and Jesus as Lord. The ascension at the beginning of Acts and Paul's proclamation at the end frame the book of Acts. And it could be that this was a bracketing technique that Luke used, because he uses it in his gospel with the temple, for example. Jesus' followers were unequivocal. Jesus will return. In essence, this means that the new age, the kingdom initiated by the resurrection, will be brought to fulfillment. God will put all things right in and through Jesus. We are living in the meantime in patience and faith. We are called to follow Jesus and bring in the kingdom on earth as it is in heaven. We are to do this not as militant revolutionaries or as advocates of triumphalism, but as Jesus modeled for us through love, compassion, peace, and humility. This brings us today, to today, and to the church. The church as people who give allegiance to Jesus as Lord. The church as the place where heaven and earth intersect. The church as the place where God's new kingdom is lived out. In the end, the placard on the cross was correct. Jesus really was the King of the Jews, bringing in a new kingdom, albeit he was a new kind of king and a new kind of kingdom that no one really saw coming. His victory came with great joy and with great cost, but it was supremely worth it for him and for his followers. Who is Jesus Christ? We'll spend a lifetime answering and understanding that question. Now, if you'll bear with me, if I can have a couple of you to help me do this. Someone start passing these out over here. In case you're wondering, this is an abbreviated bibliography. There are hundreds of thousands of books in the on this topic. But I've listed five here. I've listed five here for your help, I hope. Two of them, and I'll speak to this when we get to them. Two of them, though, give extended resources. So if you're looking for several other resources, two of these books have some help there that can help you with that. Kenneth Bailey is the first one of these books that I've listed for you, Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes, Cultural Studies in the Gospels. Kenneth Bailey spent decades living in the Middle East, and he uses this experience to help get at the culture of the first century and help people understand something of the world in which Jesus lived. And so that will be a helpful book. One other thing I might say about these books give different perspectives on who is Christ. So it's not just slanted in one particular viewpoint. Marcus Bard and N.T. Wright do exactly that. These are two different perspectives on who is Jesus Christ. These two guys are friends, and it's obvious. They don't agree, but they speak quite civilly with one another. And so it's a delight to read this book, and it's very helpful, and it will put you on to some resources at hand. Shisaku Endo wrote his book originally as a series of articles for a Japanese periodical several years ago, and it took Tokyo by storm. The book was a result of these articles that he wrote, but it's a portrait. Shisaku Endo, as I recall, studied in the West, did some theological studies, and then moved back to his home, Japan. But this book is a look at Jesus through Japanese cultural eyes. And it is very interesting, gives a very interesting perspective on how at least Japanese Christians perceive Jesus. And it helps give us some new perspective on who is this man, Jesus Christ. Yaroslav Pelikan, Jesus Through the Centuries, is a way of looking at how Jesus was perceived and taught in various centuries throughout the Christian faith. And he gives a ton of help here. He delivered these as a series of lectures for both scholar and laypersons. So it's very readable, very helpful. Me too. And finally, N.T. Wright, Simply Jesus, A Vision of Who He Was, What He Did, and Why He Matters, is one particular perspective on Jesus, but I found it very helpful and very insightful, particularly this insight of Jesus bringing in the kingdom and the future invading the present. So it's a new way of looking at Jesus and reading through the Gospels, and he presents a very compelling case for it. And the other thing that he does is to present a wide-ranged bibliography at the end of his work. So of the two books here that I mentioned, Pelikan and Wright would be helpful for giving you extra or additional resources.